All right, part of life, part of life. We got the Lebedik of Dafking Vaita. The news, I don't know if it's good or bad. It's just beyond comprehension. And of course, we're not getting the full story. We only get what the Arabs say. But all right, Nikavela Tov. Well, no, we don't know what the truth is. Gantz is having a field day now criticizing the government that once again... they folded and gave in, and it is. Every few weeks they're going to shoot, and now it's 900 rockets. In 2 weeks it'll be, God forbid, 1,500. And the money and the gas, but all right, I don't know. I can't believe Netanyahu and company are such idiots, but okay. Ein ma lasot, we don't know what's going on, and we have to just lay back and... Nekavela Tov. It's a tragedy. Four people killed. One, a Gerach Hasid visiting from America. Two, a Sephardic guy who was one of the hearts of the religious Sephardic community in Ashkelon. Then a Bedouin was killed, Nebuch, working down at the border in his car. It seems that was an anti-tank missile that hit his car, which is very serious, and then someone from Thailand who came to work here and killed two. All right, let's do what we can. Today is May 6th, 2019, and I want to say hello to the wonderful students in front of me. I have a lot to do today. It's a day filled with and a lot to give out, but let's do Shlav Shlav. Yesterday's Shir Baruch Hashem, I want to say hello to many listening across the wide expanse of Jewish existence. And yesterday's Shir, I want to thank Yomo, was uploaded right after Shir, so everyone has had a chance across the world to catch up. But today we're in a different world. I just want to mention again, to be sure I corrected myself, that Reb Shimon Shapp's granddaughter, who was one of the leaders of the anti-religious Zionist movement here, whatever, Fegi Ilanit was her name. That's what Rabbi Przemski tells me. And I always had in my mind Shulamit alone. Evidently, it's an article I read 30, 40 years ago that people confuse Shulamit alone with Shulamit alone. And Shulamit alone comes as Reb Shimon's granddaughter. But it seems Zelichud v'Zelichud, and there were a number of great Rabbanim who had granddaughters that threw away Kol HaTorah Kula, and that takes us back to the Yiddish expression, Arabs Atachta, if you understand what I'm saying. That's a well-known expression, all right. She's a Mechalalat Shabbos, Ochlin Lebedet Am Trefa on Yom Kippur. That's a rabbi's daughter. All right, the rebellion is strong. We spoke about Rabbi Young in great detail. Today we're going to come back and see him from a different side, a different source. But I just want to mention that my dear student, who is temporarily in the United States, wrote to me, had one interaction with Rabbi Young. He behaved like a prince. This must have been in the early 80s. We had a cousin who was an orphan, so we tried to help him. He got engaged, and all of a sudden, rumors started to fly that the girl was not Jewish. I met with my uncle to see Rabbi Young because the girl's family were members of the Jewish Center. I went with my uncle to see Rabbi Young. I explained the situation, and the instant I said, not Jewish, he reacted immediately, straight out of the Chafetz Chaim, saying, I don't believe it. Then he said, you mean... not religious. I said, not Jewish. He said, give me a few days to check it out. He called us back a few days later, said that he visited the family and they showed him a shtag geirut from Europe and said that he knew the Beit Din and that it was completely reliable. We should not be mafak fake and should keep quiet. And so it was. They got married and Baruch Hashem today have children and grandchildren. Now, I want to come back to an individual that, unfortunately, life moves on, and you mention his name today, and people will ask you, who are you talking about? And referring to Joseph Kamenetsky. give you a drop of background, then I want him to speak for himself. Joe Kamenetsky was born in 1911. He died in 1999. He was born in Brooklyn. We'll see in a second. He came from a poor family, struggled, attended public school for a year, but his father wanted him to attend the yeshiva. And in order to afford the tuition, the father sold the family home, moved from East New York to Brownsville, and there he attended Yeshivat Rabbeinu Chaim Berlin for elementary school. High school he went on to Talmudical Academy. He then became a member of the first graduating class of Yeshiva College, graduating magna cum laude in 1932. And he got involved in Jewish education, assisted Rabbi Young when they organized a Hebrew school, the Talmud Torah. He became the director, and to a great degree, he was basically the assistant rabbi of Jewish Center. He was in charge, he was there, he was the man. When Rabbi Young was not there, everyone knew to turn to Joe Kamenetsky. He never got smicha from the yeshiva. Once he graduated college, and you'll see in a minute from his memoir, he was overwhelmed with financial responsibility. He never had the time to sit down and learn, and in order to learn Shas, Paiskim, Halacha, you have to have a clear head. He did get two private smichot, so he did have the title rabbi, but essentially everyone knew him as Dr. Kamenetsky because he later gets a doctorate in education from the Columbia School, the Columbia Teachers College. Now, following World War II, and when Rabbi Shraga Feivel Mendelovich dies, he replaces Mr. Mendelovich. He replaces Mr. Mendelovich as the executive director of Torah Masorah. It's a position that he calls for the rest of his life. To a certain degree, during that era from the late 40s through the late 90s, Dr. Kamenetsky and Torah Masorah were one and the same. They were interchangeable. He deserves a lot of credit because at many times he had to walk a tightrope. He had to be very careful. He comes from Yeshiva University. He comes from Mizrahi. His positions as far as YU and Mizrahi never changed. And yet he goes on to succeed in Torah Masorah, which as every decade goes by, becomes more right-wing and more right-wing. You all know that the United States, the gradual process that begins following World War II, I think goes on the map black and white in 56 with the prohibition against synagogue council and the mixed board of rabbis, ultimately results in an American situation, Torah-wise, which is very, very different than we might have predicted what would be in the late 30s. And here you have Joe Kamenetsky, who's a member of Yeshiva College's first graduating class, and he has to deal with the swing to the right with the Rashi Yeshiva, with personalities such as Reb Aaron Cutler, Reb Moshe Feinstein, and Reb Yitzchak Kuttner, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, Reb Gedalia Shoah, and you can go on and give the names. Many of them were understanding of YU, others were anti-YU, some were stridently anti-YU.
Related to Reb
Yaakov? Someone just told me he was distantly related. I don't know if there was a relationship, but if there was a relationship, it was not anything tangible. It was Chmei's fourth, fifth cousin, etc. He was many times mistaken that he's the son of Reb Yaakov, or they confused him with Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, because very similar names, Reb Yaakov and Reb Yosef Kamenetsky, very similar names. Now, one story told at his funeral, which I think reflects Rav Baruch Mordechai Ezrahi, one of the famous Rosh Yeshiva in Israel today, so he tells the story at his funeral when he first goes, you have to remember that, and after he retired, he and his wife came in Aliyah, and they lived here in Israel. His wife actually died not that long ago. She died in 2010. He died in 1999. So they lived in Israel for a few years. He retired in 1980, so that he had close to 20 years where he essentially lived in Israel, though he was going back and forth. And at the funeral, so Rabbi Ezrahi told the following story. Upon his first visit to America in 1973, he was in the presence of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Evidently, in 1973, it reminds you right away, this is probably after the Yom Kippur War, when all the money fell off, the yeshivas were starving, everyone was giving to Israel, and this was that famous meeting with the joint and the Rav and Rav Moshe, and evidently he was there too to try to raise funds for the yeshiva here in Yerushalayim. And he was in the presence of Rav Moshe Feinstein when Kamenetsky entered the room. He did not know who Kamenetsky was and was astonished to see Reb Moshe rising in respect for this unknown man. Afterwards, Reb Moshe explained to him, quote, this man has established Torah in America, end quote. And there's a lot of truth to that. You see, Rabbi Revel, when Rabbi Revel started talking about yeshiva, Talmudical Academy, and started talking afterwards about Yeshiva College. Rabbi Revel started talking about the fact that we have to have yeshiva, we have to have day schools. He was the first visionary who saw this concept as a movement throughout the Western world. And he was criticized. Oh, the Reform, the New York Times Element, was he criticized, and even Orthodox Jews, if you've read my work on the Rebbe, if you've read the Rebbe's sister's work, Shulamit Meiselman, the memoir she wrote, the Rebbe was criticized. Orthodox Jews, our children will be greenhorns, our children will be chutzler, l'tchum, they won't be part of the mainstream, and it was Mr. Mendelovich, with the advent of World War II, the closing, 44, I think it begins, Torah Mesora, but under Mr. Mendelovich, it was just the last years of his life, there was limited success. Under Joe Kamenetsky, Torah Mesora caught on wherever there was an attempt to organize a day school. Now, you can understand how these problems interfered with Hashkafa. And the simple example, and perhaps someday a scholarly work will be written, I will explain myself in a minute, perhaps a scholarly work will be written on the history of Torah Mesorah, an honest history, so you see one of the greatest problems they have. Boys and girls, co-ed or separate? Now, you don't have to be a great genius to understand that l'atchatchila, I don't believe there are few today in Israel, there's the Torah V'Avoda movement, it says, so some of them really believe al-pi shita, you have to have boys and girls together. But 99% or 90% of Rabbanim, of Talmidei Chachamim, certainly will tell you boys and girls should be separate. I can only quote Aaron Rekefit to you. I said it a million times. How you can teach Gemara, boys and girls together, take a sugyin ketuvah, matzah petach patuah. Please, that's the worst thing in the world is to skip sugyas. Then you leave the kid with a demented feeling and he's going to check it out. Why did the Rebbe skip the sugya?
But
say this, so Maimonides didn't have total success. You might have had more success if you'd learned ketuvah and you learned kedushin and you learned gittin. This is a very delicate question. But what, my dear friends, what do you do when you're beginning a day school and you have a total of 5 students, like the Rav began Maimonides, or like Rabbi Krauss in St. Louis? I think he began the day school with 15 students. And that's the story with Rabbi Krauss. I don't think it's any secret. He was the Talmud Mufak of Rav Yitzchak Kutner. Yitzchak Rav Chutna was that was his Rebbe. Rabbi Krauss is maybe a year or two older than I am. We're basically contemporaries. I remember Rabbi Krauss. You remember his father in Washington Heights had the shul under the bridge. The name, that was his father. Put two and two together. He has a brother. I don't know if the brother's alive yet. I have a feeling he's not. But brother was totally right-wing. Reb Simcha was total Talmud of Rav Yitzchak Kutna. No, in the year 2020, where we are today, look where Rabbi Krauss is. You got a Ke Pasa. What happened? And I can tell you, I heard this from him directly. He's a very fine individual. You have to know, he's an edel individual. He's a Talmud Chacham, but he's moved way, way beyond Rabbi Hutner's outlook, way, way to the other side. So he told me the story. He wanted to begin a day school in St. Louis. I think he had a total of 15 students. So he told Reb Yitzchak, he told his Rosh Yeshiva, that I have no choice, I have to begin co-ed. It's either that or nothing. And Rav Chutna told him, Yoharegli al Yava, you have to separate, it better not to have anything than to have boys and girls together. All right, this is a delicate question. Each one can think how they view it. And he had to organize that day school, and it was co-ed. And that was the start of his breach, his break, the chasm with his Rebbe. So you got to understand, hold on. These questions came up time and again. And at times, this I can tell you, Joe, I knew Dr. Kamenetsky, I knew Joe Kamenetsky. I knew him, I can't say intimately, but I knew him. But I also knew him quite well. How did I know him quite well? Because my cousins and the Kamenetskys were very good friends living in Borough Park. My cousins, you all know the dentist, Josh Daniel. Did I mean anything to you, Dr. Josh Daniel? His parents, Muriel and Noah Daniels, Achronim Lerach, they were tzaddik. These are people who got married in the 1940s and were from and remained from. Not a simple matter. These are families. I'm named after Josh's great-grandfather. Ich bin ein Name, sein älter Zeta, Aaron. And you got to understand, these are people who were Maisa Nefesh. Josh's great-grandmother, who's my great-aunt, or great-great-aunt, I don't know, we have to figure it out, she was revered by my family. She was, and these people remained from, and they were very close. So I got to know. So Joe Kamenetsky, give you a simple example. You're dealing with a school, let's say in Kalamazoo, Michigan, okay? You're dealing with a school in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And you only have 15 kids. So Dr. Kamenetsky is now telling the Vad HaRabbanim of Torah Mesorah, I think we should organize this school because it's either co-ed or nothing. And one of the Rosh Yeshiva will say to him, who asked you to express an opinion? Who the heck are you? A Yeshiva College graduate? Do you follow what he had to live with? And he had to know how to balance between these various opinions. Now, this is why I said a few minutes ago, Jack wondered, why did the Rebbe say we need a scholarly history of Torah Mesorah? Because this memoir, Joe Kamenetsky told me himself, he censored himself. You follow? It's not that the facts are not correct, but not all the facts are there. He censored himself. He didn't want to get involved with the nitty-gritty because had he written the true story, the wind-up would have been like making of a guttle. What's wrong with what the Reb Nosson Kamenetsky wrote? I'll tell you what's wrong. He told the truth. When you said, we're living in a world, you understand, this is a delicate question. I can't say I've had total success, but all my life I always felt if I don't tell the truth, it's a fadokenkeit. Let us say that in English. I'll raise students who are not honest. And once you're not honest with Jewish history, you're not honest with Torah, you're not honest with God, you're not honest with your wife, you're not honest with your children, you're not honest with your money. Yitzchak, you're reading me? It's a fadokenkeit. We have to be honest. I can't say I succeeded with every student. I've had students who said to me, this they'll quote a so-called Adam Gadol, look what he did here, look what he did there. Could be we should hide the facts, but you can't hide indefinitely. It creeps out. It becomes knowledge. Better to be honest and pay the price than to raise people who have cunningness and slyness and these depicable traits and go further and get away with it. All right, I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but this is why we could use a real honest history. Okay, yes, Yitzchak, you wanted to ask something. You okay?
Yes, and in the matter of co-ed.
Yeah.
The Rav's two daughters.
Right.
They would be the ones who would know. Did he or did he not start a co-ed school because of the requirements, or he believed it?
No. So I spoke with, I'll tell you, after the movie came out, the documentary on the Rav, so a lot of people hit me hard because there the point was made that the Rav felt if the school would not be co-ed, the girls would not get a good education in Torah subjects. He wanted them to get the same education as men. So I told people, I'm not the one to blame. There's a producer, he takes responsibility. I can't interfere, I have to move to the side. I raised the money, that's true. I made the connection, but I'm a team player. And I said, not only that, the person who gave us $1 million, and I have to recall his name with awe, Abe Lebovitz, and I have to tell you, we didn't have the schnoz, we were able to put out a world-class documentary on the Rav that has been seen until today by tens and tens and tens of thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands, because it was shown prime-time Israeli television a number of times, and it was shown all over the world.
It was on the internet for a while.
It was seen all over the world. It's available. You can buy it, I think, for $25. There's a better edition. The one they're selling has even more to it now. And we didn't have to schnoz, didn't have to embarrass. Now, his take was like the producer's take. The producer was greatly influenced by him, obviously, had every right to be. And they really had this take that the Rav felt it was important to be co-ed for the sake of the girls getting an education. When I was at the tail end of the publication of the Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, so I went to Boston. First of all, I went to the Rav's grave to ask Mechila, who the heck am I, a little kid from the Bronx, to publish two volumes on the Rav, which until today, these works is available 20 years already. Tens and tens of books have come out in the Rav. But if you need to know who the Rav really was, read what people say, which books you go to. Okay? So Baruch Hashem, the books have found their place in the sun. Chutzpah, so I went to ask Mechila from the Rav. Okay. Obviously, I went to visit Atara. And I asked Atara a few questions. This is one of the questions I asked her. So I said to her, I had a feeling the Rav was opposed to co-ed education. I said, I'll bring you simple proof. When I was a young Rosh Yeshiva in YU, I told you the story many times. I relive it. I see it right in front of me. We're in room 103. Yitzhak, do you remember room 103? Rabbi Palayev's room, the end room, not the room which the Rav taught. It's a Friday morning. The whole faculty, all the Rosh Yeshiva are assembled there. And Dr. Belkin now wants to bring Stern College uptown. He had a chance to get, there was a senior citizen's residence a few blocks from Yeshiva in Inwood. I think it was called the Beth Abraham, whatever it was. He had a chance to get it for a dollar. In other words, the people were willing to sponsor it, the government's willing to intervene. There was money made available. He could bring Stern College uptown, which solved the whole problem of space and take them out of the middle of Manhattan, where to rent one room you have to pay $1 million a week. And tremendous outcry. And there was a petition the Rav signed first that if they bring Stern College uptown, the entire faculty Rosh Yeshiva faculty will resign. So does that show you that the Rav is in favor or against? So I said that to Atara. So she told me, look, that's an older age, and the Rav was Chayshish. You understand, let's not spell it out, but at that age in life, consenting adults, you don't know what's going to happen. So I said to Atara, if that's the case, then nowadays we have to be opposed to co-education in high schools. She agreed with me. I don't have to tell you what goes on in high schools. I want to tell you what talk you can ask these kids from Torah Shraga. I remember yet the BMT kids already in the 70s, the language, the interaction, the relationship. So the question hangs fire. What about an elementary school? I don't think we're chayshish. I hope not, although the way the world is changing, God have mercy. Dennis Prager would agree with me, Jack. God have mercy, what can come out of it? So I don't know, I cannot answer you, but I will tell you this as a fact. A book has just come out now on how the five towns became the five towns. It's written by a Kamenetsky, a grandson of Reb Yaakov. He gives his father, Reb Binyamin, the credit for creating the five towns. And the book covers through 1980. And I'm told the book is very balanced. It's a coffee table book, a lot of pictures. In other words, anyone from the five towns whose grandparents helped bring this miracle about are going to want this book on their table. And about the rabbis who were there, Rabbi Klapperman, etc. So here you have Hailai organized. Hailai was semi-coed when it began. Hailai morphs into, what's it called today? Hafta. You follow? Hebrew Academy of the Five Towns. And Hailai, and the name is Hafta. There was a merger. So I can tell you, when Hailai was being organized, this is the late 1950s. So the big question was whether it would be co-ed or whether it would be separate. And already then, the right wing was influencing somewhat the five towns. You got to remember, the five towns of the 1950s was the most religious shul was Bet Shalom, was Rabbi Klapperman, was with the mechitza that resembles the Jewish center mechitza at that time. I don't know the way it is today. I think they improved their mechitza. But it was a different ballpark. But yet there was an element that wanted separate classes. So they came to the Rav. And I remember among the delegation that came to the Rav was Rabbi Harold Lyman. I remember that clearly, the father of Professor Lyman. Schneer Lyman, he was a Talmud of Mr. Mendelovich, and if I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Pelkowitz came, the father of David Pelkowitz, Rabbi Ralph Pelkowitz. These were the legendary people who built Yiddishkeit in the five, Far Rockaway, Lawrence, the five towns, when who would dream that anyone but a Reformed Jew would have the money and the ability to live there. So we heard they were coming. You know, we were yentis. We knew what was going on. It was you couldn't keep secrets in the yeshiva. So they went in. They met with the Rav in Dr. Belkin's office. Dr. Belkin's little conference room right off. Remember, when you come into the yeshiva, if you turn left, you have the classrooms where the Rav taught, 103, where Rabbi Palev taught, where Rabbi Lifshitz taught. But if you turn right, there's Dr. Belkin's office, Mr. Abram's office, the administrative offices, and Dr. Belkin had a bit of a conference room there, and that's where they met. And on my word of honor, we were outside the door trying to, you've seen this in movies where they try to listen to the door, what's going on. And what we got out of it was the Rav told them, gentlemen, don't try to learn from what I did. I had no choice when I organized my Maimonides. It was five students. It was either co-ed or nothing. You have to decide in accordance with your response, with your situation, with your balabatim, with the parents, etc. So I would say it is questionable whether the Rav really felt lachatchila. I would like to believe, but I hope it's not Rakefet putting his own thought into it, that the Rav in an ideal world would agree we have to have separate classes, men and women. But there's no question that the Rav felt very strongly that boys and girls have to get the same education. And this is why he said, and here the Rebbe was ahead of his time, he was avant-garde, he was absolutely correct. We're living in a world where the girls are going to go to college, where the girls are going to go to graduate school. As you know, the Rebbe's two daughters both got doctorates, and they're exposed to every type of study in the world. If they're not exposed to an intensive Torah education, they may not be able to answer the challenges. So there's no question he felt very strongly about girls learning. Which brings us into the problems of today, but we'll leave that for another time. Where do we draw the line? Where do we draw the line? Girls are learned, girls are smart, girls are capable. Girls, I have students, my own dermatologist is a lady who's considered the top dermatologist in Yerushalayim, and she's my student. What can I tell you? She told my wife I made her year when she was here in Mechwala. All right, I can understand that. It was already the 80s with the whole Haredizatzia and a lot of tensions. I made her year. She's my dermatologist today. I had a student in Mechangol, and she's a heart surgeon today. Yeah, you have students, new, and you can say, all right, I have students, one a medical doctor, I think she's gone through Shas already twice. Al Haseda, a maiden named Dina Cohn. She's married to my student, married to Sammy. Okay, so where do you draw the line? Oh, and this is not a simple problem. Why can't they be rabbis? Why can't they have a title? If they do a PhD in Jewish history, just as they say to Rakefet, Dr. Rothkopf, they call her Dr. whatever her last name is. Right or wrong, though, if you follow, where do you draw the line? And why can't they have the title rabbi? And they can learn better than 90% of the rabbanim that got smicha from the chief rabbinate in Israel. Dina Cohn is a genius. She wrote an article on cancer and halacha and women and mikvah. It was in tradition. I said no man could have written an article like that. She had all the learning, the knowledge, but she's a woman. She knows a woman's body. No man. So where do you draw the line? All right, this is what we're struggling with today. All right, but okay. Now, Dr. Kamenetsky, towards the end of his life, 1995, when he was not as old as I am today, but hitting 80, wrote a memoir. It's not exactly an autobiography, a memoir. Memorable Encounters, 1995. And here, the world comes to life before your eyes. And it's a shame. He should have written more and more sources, because it's the era which he lived is very fascinating. But let me begin at the beginning. He tells the story how his father, what we mentioned a minute ago, sold everything, moved, downsized, so he could go to Chaim Berlin. Bronzeville, at that time, East New York, it was like living in a ghetto. You didn't know what the big world was. It's like today, growing up in Borough Park, could be parts of Flatbush, and I've had this experience myself. You meet Jews, Talmidei Chachamim, you speak with them, and they speak English with an accent. And you ask them, where were you born? And they look at you, they were born in Brooklyn. How could you speak English with an accent if you were born in Brooklyn? But see, this is ghettoization. And his whole life, he really, really knew, he says, I knew nothing outside of Bronzeville. When he was 13, and he started to go to Talmudical Academy on the Lower East Side, the Lower East Side, there he was exposed to the world. That's where I'm quoting him, those years brought me out into the world, so to speak. For until age 13 or so, I had known little of anything outside of Bronzeville. Now, Herbie, what do you mean it brought him into the world? The East Side? Yeah. So your gut reaction is the East Side is also a ghetto. Not exactly. The East Side had immigrants from every different country that you could imagine. Every type of Jew, every type of Italian, every type of Irishman. Not only that, the East Side, because it had so many Jews, because it was the hotbed of Jewish civilization 150 years ago, 100 years ago, every type of organization was there. Not just religious Jews, not just semi-Hasidic Jews. I use the word semi because we're talking 100 years ago. Every type of socialist, every type of communist, every type of Bundist, every type of anarchist. You don't know what went on the East Side. And then you had the Yiddish theater. This is going to come back. It's going to haunt us a little later today, next week, whatever, you'll see. You'll understand what we're talking about when we talk about making of a gavel. But this was the reality. You know what the Yiddish theater was? Go look at some of my grandparents. My grandparents my grandfather, I think, had a box in the Yiddish theater. This is my grandfather who learned in Volozhin. My grandfather, my grandmother, who came from Tzaddikim Yisrael Olam, through this grandmother, I'm a blood relative, to use the word I was corrected on yesterday. I'm a blood relative of Rabbi Revel. I'm a blood relative of the Rosh Yeshiva of Chevron. Today, I'm talking today, Rabbi Kohn. We're all Kalvariskis. I'm a blood relative of all. They went to the Yiddish theater, and you know what the Yiddish theater was? They mocked religion. All right, that was low-key, because people still had a folk feeling, a folk milieu feeling for religion. But sex, was wholesale, that's what got a laugh out of the audience. That's what sells, let's put it that way. And this was what went on the Lower East Side. It opened the world to you, willy-nilly. Then you got to remember, where Brooklyn is Brooklyn, to get from Brooklyn to Manhattan, even today. Please, Dove, where did you live before you came in Aliyah?
Teaneck.
One second. Vic, to get from Brooklyn to Manhattan, it's a schlep, yes or no? That you followed, that's today, with all the modern transportation. It's gotten worse, as a matter of fact, because everyone has a car. I think they're now outlawing cars beneath 60 if you have to be taxed. I saw already in an Israeli newspaper over the weekend or yesterday that they want to introduce the plan here. People are talking about it. If you bring a car into the center of Tel Aviv, the center of Jerusalem, you're photographed, you're licensed, you're taxed. It was a schlep. But the Lower East Side, it's not only the Lower East Side. You got into the 3rd Avenue L, afterwards the subway. Within 10 minutes, you were in the heart of the world. 42nd Street, 34th Street. Right, millions of tourists. You know what Manhattan is like, beginning now when the weather gets a little better, although the Yankees, the game was called at the end of 8 innings yesterday. The Yankees won, rain. And could you imagine Yomo, who's been in America for how many years already? This morning I had to explain to him the concept that after 5 innings, if the game is called, the score still counts. So Yomo Klera Hakira is, what's the pshat? That the 5 innings are the heart of the game? Or it's just a b'dievet concept, but the game, the heart of it can come afterwards. I told him it can come afterwards. You can have 0-0 at the end of 5 innings. So even if you call the game, it accomplishes nothing. But if a guy hits a home run in the 6th inning, that counts. So I didn't agree with Yomo's Hakira, but Ribbono Shel Olam, you travel all over the world, tourists are pouring in, 34th Street, 42nd Street, Broadway, oh, Times Square, what are we talking about? Macy's, Gimbel's, wow. Knew a little kid from Bronzeville, suddenly is on the Lower East Side, the world opens for him. Then there's another part of his memoir, which is quite important, and you have to understand it in context. He gets involved, this is post-World War I, gets involved with Hapoel Mizrahi. My friends and I joined the organization, this gave us such satisfaction. We became so committed to it that we traveled, we preached, we spoke in synagogues. And at that time, there was no criticism, no concept that you're compromising yourself. And what is he talking about? See, it's very hard for us to understand today. Following World War I, in the entire United States, there was only one rabbi, I've said this many times, who was not an official Mizrahi. It was Reb Hirsch Grzeszynski from Nebraska, Reb Chaim Moise's cousin. They say about him that he knew every last line in Tosfot by heart. And he was a Rav HaMachshir, made a living from the slaughter of cattle in the Middle West. But to be a Mizrahiite, Chas v'Chalila, his cousin, the founder of Agudat Yisrael, Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah, Chaim Ezra Grzeszynski, he was the only one in all of the United States. And there was no, what was the problem? Mizrahi, Eretz Yisrael, the Am Yisrael, Al-Pi Torah Yisrael, and following World War I, where Jews were slaughtered and so many pogroms, we needed a Mizrahi, we needed Eretz Yisrael. So here's this kid that he's in MTA, he's on the Lower East Side, he's exploring the world, he's exposed to a poem Mizrahi. And here's the most beautiful part of the memoir. I shall never forget that exciting day in the old TA building on East Broadway when Dr. Shelley Sapphire, the high school principal, came into room 208 where Mr. Sternbach was giving a lesson. And he told us, quote, "We're all going to open a yeshiva college." This was revolutionary. A Jewish institution for training the Jewish professionals of tomorrow. The brainchild of REITS founder and president, Dr. Bernard Revel. And this is what I told you years ago, if you recall. Rabbi Revel was very troubled. Why? He organized yeshiva, the high school, Talmudical Academy. 4 years later, these kids, who are all of 17 and not exactly a mature individual, are going to Columbia University. If you can't afford Columbia, you went to City College, which was, at that time, second only to Columbia University. It had the greatest professors, brilliant Jewish kids who couldn't afford Columbia U. What an experience. And yeshiva was losing so many kids. How many remained from? How many remained held by learning? And he engendered this idea, just as we have a Talmudical Academy, we need a yeshiva university. And this was epic making. 1928, Yeshiva College opens its doors. Joe Kamenetsky is one of the just graduated high school. He's part of the opening class. Now, you can't appreciate, we who grew up, and most of us sitting in this room, many of us are Yeshiva College graduates, we don't know how thankful we have to be. I'll give you just a simple example. I learned in Lakewood, and my parents wanted me to go to yeshiva. How can you not have a college degree? Go to yeshiva college. My mother had gone to college. The depression ended. My father and mother both dropped out of school during the depression, and they never got their college degrees, but they looked at me, a kid, not to have college. All right, I wound up in yeshiva college. Just think for a minute how beautiful and easy it was. All right, it was a long day, but we accomplished two worlds. 8:30 in the morning, yeshiva began. 9 o'clock in the morning, yeshiva began. You in a real yeshiva, real learning. Imagine, room 102, a little kid from the Bronx could block Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, had to get in and out of his chair. I had to stand up. I was blocking him, sitting right here. Imagine. And then at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you went up to college. You didn't have to travel. You didn't have to waste time. And it was a regular college. And this was a great, great achievement, a great vision. I can tell you, I'm reading a memoir now. My neighbor, I live in a building that's had very, very famous, world-famous people living there. Over the building is 50 years old. I'm living there 50 years, and only a few of us are still around from the original occupants, the original tenants, or the original owners of the building. We're not tenants. We actually own our apartments. And one of my famous neighbors, Shadim Miwell, is Dr. Moshe Mandelbaum. Make believe you've heard the name, so the ignorant pass for the wise. You all heard of the Mandelbaum house. You know what I'm talking about? Shah Mandelbaum, where you went to Jordan. That was the connection. It's within walking distance of here, believe me. I can't walk it today, but my grandchildren can walk it in a minute. And he was Negid Bank Yisrael in the 1980s. He played a big role in straightening out the economy. He was a PhD in economics from Nashville, University of Tennessee in Nashville, Tennessee, which specialized in economics, had a very good department. And he just wrote a memoir. He's older than I am, and a fascinating memoir. And he describes the family. He comes from Dorei Dorot of Shomrei Torah Mitzvah. His wife Sarah is a great-granddaughter of Rav Moshe Yoel Solomon, the founder of Petach Tikva. And he was learning in Hebron. And he was learning first in Panovich, then in Hebron, with Gedolei Rashi Yeshiva of Shmuel Rezapsky. And he was loved learning. But his family said, look, we're a family of business people. You have to get a degree. You have to study. We want you to go to Hebrew U. And they told him in Hebron, you can't continue here. We can't have students learning in Hebron and going to Hebrew U. It'll be a very bad example for the other students in the yeshiva. And he had to give up learning. In other words, he left the serious learning and winds up in Hebrew U, and from Hebrew U on to his PhD and on to a very distinguished career in teaching and above all in administrating and president, being the guardian of the monetary state status of the State of Israel. What's the purpose? Governor of the Bank. Negid Bank Israel is the title in Hebrew. But we owe a great deal of credit. So here, this kid was so happy. We're talking about Joe Kamenetsky, and he goes on to Yeshiva College. Now, when he starts college, tragedy strikes at home. His father takes ill with Parkinson's disease, has to stop working. There were 9 children at home, plus a niece and nephew, whom my father had brought to America from Slunim, his hometown in Lithuania. No, 1928, 29, 30, what are we talking about? The years of the Great Depression. Yeshiva gave him a stipend, $6 a week. And you got to give Yeshiva credit, these were the ladies. The ladies' organization, they raised the money. Their responsibility were stipends for the students, in my time as well. I can tell you, I don't recall what I got, but also I had free meals, whatever, that was all through Yeshiva University's women's organization. Ah, these were very difficult years for Joe Kamenetsky. My children and grandchildren still look at me quizzically when I tell them we had to eat bread and halva for supper every now and then. And of course, it's hard for us to believe today, Kanayin Hara, the level on which we live and eat, and kosher food. And this was the reality. Bread and halva. Halva was always a Jewish treat, particularly the Russian Jews, the Lithuanian Jews. I don't know how much the Sephardic Jews valued halva, but I know as a kid growing up, halva was considered a staple, the basic treat of our existence. And he describes the depression, how it hit the yeshiva, and how that entire plot of land had to be sold off, and how it hurt Dr. Revel. People attribute it to ultimately his heart trouble. He didn't live that much longer. Within 10 years after the Depression hits, he's basically dead. He's a sick man and dead, a youngster at the age of 55. But Yeshiva bought up that land in the early 20s, 1924, I believe it was bought, 23, 24. That entire land was farmland. It was bought for next to nothing. Yeshiva owned all the land down to the Harlem River. There was nothing there. There were no buildings there. Could you imagine what the campus would be like today? And all that land had to be sold off to keep the yeshiva able to survive the Depression. And that's what he recounts, something I write about in Revel, but here you have an eyewitness. And he describes no one. The leading personality was Dr. Bernard Revel. He was an English-speaking Rosh Yeshiva who had been involved in an oil business in the Midwest. And he said, I got to know Rabbi Revel even better than most students. Why? Because his classmate, this was the first class of Yeshiva College, Lou Engelberg of Memphis, Tennessee. Recognize the name? Anyone here go to Machon Lev? Rabbi Abba Engelberg? I believe this is his father. Oh. Lou Engelberg was very close to Rabbi Revel's son, Norman. Rabbi Revel had two sons, Norman and Hirschel. I yet knew Norman quite well. Norman was the older one. Hirschel died in 61. Mrs. Revel cried to me many times she couldn't have more children. She felt bad that she just had two sons, didn't have a daughter, obviously. And Norman was very close to Lou Engelberg. So Norman viewed Lou as his big brother. So they would constantly visit the Revels in the Broadmoor Hotel where the Revels lived. That was once a very nice little hotel, 101st, the 101st Street, 102nd Street, if I recall, 101st, I believe, and Broadway. And I still, when it wasn't such a beautiful hotel anymore, that's where I made the acquaintance of the family, Rabbi Revel's archives that were there, etc. And he says, I would constantly visit, and I became very close to Rabbi Revel, being the good friend of the big brother to his eldest son, Norman. And there, I became friendly not only with Dr. Revel, but with his wonderful wife, who was a great personality in her own right, a warm and generous woman. And I have to tell you, in my new book, I describe there's some new material on Mrs. Revel. She was a very unique woman, totally committed to Torah, American-born, raised in far, far from New York City, far, far from any Torah, raised public school, and yet her entire gestalt was the love of Torah. The Travis family, she, her brother, Shlomo Travis, Sal Travis, amazing what can come out of Marietta, Ohio, and her love of Torah, her love of the students, just the way he describes her, a warm and generous person. I would add the word gracious, gracious. Okay. Now, Dr. Revel got to know him, and he says, it seemed to me that Rabbi Revel recognized the spark of leadership ability in me. As a matter of fact, my feelings were confirmed when he called me into his office one day to inform me that the yeshiva was bringing an Eloi over from Russia, a great Talmud Chacham named Chaim Zimmerman. And he recognized the name, this Reb Chaim Zimmerman. And boy, an Eloi understatement. How many of you ever met Reb Chaim Zimmerman? Again, I got to know him many different ways. One of them was through the connection of Kamenetsky and my cousin Daniel. They became his very devoted students in Brooklyn, in Borough Park. Reb Chaim Zimmerman. And before I read what he says here, let me give you the background. How did Reb Chaim Zimmerman get to America? Who was his uncle? Reb Baruch Ber Leibowitz. Reb Baruch Ber Leibowitz was married to a Zimmerman. Reb Chaim's father was a Rav, and Reb Baruch Ber married the Rav's daughter. So Reb Baruch Ber was his uncle. And Reb Baruch Ber threw him out of Europe and told him to get the heck out and beat it over to Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Hanan in America. Now, can anyone tell me why? Not a big secret. Reb Chaim Zimmerman had a total photographic memory, knew Kol HaTorah Kula. So he also decided to know every science in the world. Did you ever meet a greater mathematician than Reb Chaim? How many of you read his works? Who was the greatest scientist? At least he considered himself right up there with the biggest scientist in the world. He studied every autodidactic. Reb Chaim, no, in Europe, a kid like this, with a mind like this, Reb Baruch Ber's nephew, oy vey, Reb Baruch Ber threw him out and told him, get to America, and Dov saved his life. You understand what I'm saying? Had he remained behind, he would have been, add another one to the 6 million. Now, here, he wanted me to befriend the young genius and Americanize him. The saga of my relationship with Reb Chaim I may sometime record. It's a shame he didn't. Suffice it to say that within a period of about a month, Reb Chaim was teaching me some aspects of America that I never knew about. The abundance of Russian tea rooms on the east side, for one. And if you understand what I'm saying, what I alluded to a few minutes ago, he's censoring what Reb Chaim Zimmerman really taught him. I think it's a lot more than the tea rooms, the theaters, the programs, the parties, the political parties, the apikorsim. Reb Chaim Zimmerman, what a mind, what a person. And this is so revealing. Because here's Rabbi Revel taking Joe Kamenetsky, Yosef Kamenetsky, Americanized Reb Chaim Zimmerman. All right, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But Reb Chaim Zimmerman opened the world to him that he never saw in Brooklyn, and never saw in Best Nurse, never saw on East New York. Ah, the tea rooms, and probably a lot more. Now, I can only tell you, in consonance of what we spoke about before, Reb Chaim Zimmerman, unfortunately, never really achieved his real place in life. He winds up becoming the assistant rabbi, the rabbi in the Beis Medrash of Rabbi Wahlberg Shul in what was it called in Borough Park, Rabbi Wahlberg? Shomri Amuna, right. I knew Amuna was in it. Shomri Amuna, Rabbi Wahlberg, Harry Wahlberg, all his sons became rabbis. He was a short guy. When he opened his mouth, he was the equal of Joe Lookstein. Did you ever hear him talk? Peh Mapik Magoliot. He was fabulous. Perfect English, perfect Yiddish. But there was a downstairs Beis Medrash where they wanted total Yiddish and learn Gemara. So Reb Chaim Zimmerman was the rabbi of that kahal. And one of the classic Reb Chaim Zimmerman stories, which I heard many, many times, my cousin and Joe Kamenetsky, you know, they came in. It was an early Shabbos during the winter, 4:20, 4:30, and they're coming in for Mincha, all ready for Shabbos, and there's Reb Chaim Zimmerman sitting and learning and writing, totally didn't look at the watch. Rebbe, if it's about Shabbos, he had to jump up and run home, change quickly and get back to shul. But that's Reb Chaim, totally enmeshed in learning. He winds up in Chicago, and that's the story you've all heard 100 times over, where David Applebaum, Hashem Yikom Damo, used to cry. He would say to me, Reb Aaron, for you it's history. I lived it. For me it's tears and emotion. and Reb Chaim Zimmern, and then with the graduation, remember, but with Purim, and at the Purim Seder, the Reb Chaim Zimmern got up and said, and and I'll tell you a good piece of Torah that even the big Apikoris sitting here, Dr. Berkowitz, will agree it's good. And Dr. Berkowitz, Professor Berkowitz, threw a dish at him, you understand? And the next day, the board of directors met and fired Reb Chaim Zimmern. And that's the tragedy with Reb Aaron Soloveitchik, that they offered him the position, and he was young, wanted to be on his own, not in his brother's limelight in Chicago, and they brought him to Chicago. But Reb Aaron didn't realize that these Balabatim, if they can fire Reb Chaim Zimmern, these are Balabatim who rule, not the opposite. And then there was issue after issue. The biggest one was the Mizrahi. The old Mizrahi building was in an area that was going bad. And they sold the building, I think, to, again, someone from Chicago can correct me, to a Buddhist temple, a Buddhist something. And Reb Aaron absolutely acid. And the Balabatim told them to go fly a kite. And a lot of Akmastefish. Then Reb Aaron went out on his own and organized brisk, and heartache. But all right, Reb Aaron raised wonderful children, but I wish his life, Alei Adama, would have been better without all that Akmastefish. Then Akmastefish from the right wing, don't ask what Reb Aaron went through. But that's the story with Reb Chaim Zimmern. I'll add on one other thought. That Reb Chaim's Chavruta was my youngest brother's father-in-law. In other words, Rav Dov Sherman. He was a Rebbe in Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. Anyone who went to Rabbi Yaakov Yosef will recognize the name Rav Dov Sherman. Rav Dov Sherman was also a tremendous Talmud Chacham, but modern Hebrew, a poet in Hebrew, very fascinating individual. And he taught Najj. He was Reb Chaim Zimmern's Chavruta. When Reb Chaim came to the yeshiva and he needed someone to, and a Chavruta to learn with, that was Reb Dov Sherman. 1969, Reb Chaim came in Aliyah, and here too, I don't want to spell it all out, too many people are listening. Rabbi Shlomo Gorin wanted to make him a member of the Beit and HaGadol. Rabbi Shlomo Gorin was overwhelmed by his knowledge, but Rabbi Avadya Yosef said, I have to test him. All right, I don't want to go further. If you think a Litvish Gadol, a nephew, a plemenic from Rebarach Be'ah, is going to let himself be tested by some Svadik Rav, it did not work out. But I remember Reb Chaim Zimmern used to sit in Heichel Shlomo in the library. Once they had a very active library there, and all the Sfarim. And one time I went to talk with him in learning. I had a question, Allah, I remember, with Ribbit, the whole question. And he was sitting and learning, talking to me, and writing at the same time. It was like three, these are geniuses, like Bernie Land. I remember I saw Bernie Lander in a restaurant. I said to Malka, don't go near him. And we watched him from afar. He's talking with someone. He's reading the New York Times, and they're bringing him a telephone, you know, with the long, 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 long wire, and all three things, talking, on the telephone, New York Times. These are geniuses, and they can do it all. All right, now, and there's one more description here, too, which I heard from so many people, but here's a live description, how Rabbi Rebel was always one of the boys who would greet us amiably. Students were really fond of him. While we joked with him, but we really laughed at his usual question, and he quotes it, Ot, how is your Yirat Shemayim? V'yis ayah Yirat Shemayim. How is your Yirat Shemayim? And that's what he would ask the students. And for us, this was a true exemplar of what became Yeshiva's credo, a harmonization of Torah and secular learning. All right. Now we've brought him to Rabbi Young. Here's, that's his background, Bronzeville, TA, Yeshiva College. The first graduating class of Yeshiva College, every last person becomes a Shem Dava. And if any of you want to make a contribution and be wealthy, this book you'll be able to sell to a good publisher. You won't have to struggle like Rakefet, limited access. I'm holding in front of me the first Matmid, 1932, the first Yeshiva College class. And here it is, history before your eyes. The students,
how many were there?
We'll see in a second, one second. Here's Joseph Kamenetsky, right here. Joseph Kamenetsky, Brooklyn, New York. I am going to say that we will have a great Masmid, please God. He was the editor. How many are there? 8? 16, 19. And he describes some of the names. I can don't have to read what he says. Here, Louis Engelberg, Memphis, Tennessee, who we spoke about. David Kalavensky, recognize the name. He goes on to become a conservative rabbi, although remains in his own life religious. Jacob Hartstein, first registrar of the Yeshiva College. Max Hach, no, can anyone tell me? Steve Breslow would know who that is. He was rabbi of the Young Israel right near Yankee Stadium. Big Young Israel, one time filled with Jews. Louis Eisenstein, that's Rabbi Lazar Silver's son-in-law, later becomes a medical doctor. Joe Kamenetsky, looking. Eli Levine, remember Eli Levine? Even giant minds come in cozy models these days. Eli Levine, maybe he's all of 5'3", 5'4". Scientist, taught, I think he was a chemist, taught chemistry at Yeshiva College. Mendel Lewittis, my lived in one of the original settlers in 18 Berlin. Rabbi of Montreal, previously in Boston, famous rabbi, Menachem Mendel Lewittis. Hugo Mantel, very odd name, final years right here in Makkastuff, if I'm not mistaken. Morris Penkower, well-known rabbi. Chaim Mas, very wealthy, a builder. Real estate, until today, the Mas family has given a great deal to Yeshiva. By the way, we're distant relatives. This is also, I got to ask my brother. My brother has track. He was classmates with Chaim Mas's son. I think his name is Josh Mas. Joshua Matz, recognize the name? He was a controller in Yeshiva University for many, many, many decades. Very fascinating. Julius Washer. Recognize the name?
My son,
Julius Lazar, your son, the rabbi.
Julius or Judah?
Here it says Julius, but his name in Hebrew might have been Julia. I don't know, it has to be checked if it's the same person. And here, this, I don't know how I got this, but here, what does it read? Julie Washer, with compliments, Joe Kamenetsky. You follow? And in it you have here, like everything else, contributions, students, faculty, greetings, Rabbi Revel, Dr. Sapphire. Now, here in Yeshiva College, he meets Rabbi Young. And here I'll end off this part of the class shortly. I just want to show you the greatness of Rabbi Young. Rabbi Young, teaching ethics and philosophical roots. And Rabbi Joe Kamenetsky writes, or Dr. Kamenetsky, really what he taught was above our heads. But I was attracted to him and would invariably walk him to the subway after class. And yes, this was a frequent sight in Washington Heights. I remember in 56, we walked about 10 of us surrounded the Rav, walking him to the subway. And Charlie, you know what we were talking about? Adlai Stevenson. And I remember he was running against Eisenhower for the second time, I believe. And the Rav said, "Ay, halavai, Stevenson should be elected. That is an intellectual. That's a man we can be proud of. But he doesn't stand a chance because the masses love a war hero." You followed the Rav's insight there. Not bad, not bad. I remember that as a kid. And so during the chats, he would often mention to Rabbi Young the situation in his house, that his father can't work, there's so many children. Good friend that he was, he asked me to teach his daughters Erna and Rosalie. Rabbi Young, among his children, had two daughters. Rosalie later lives in Israel. This is Rosenfeld. Her son was one of the early graduates of Machon Lev. And when I came to his house in the afternoon, I was giving a glass of milk before starting the lessons with the girls. The entire family welcomed me warmly and treated me royally. So, for about 2 years or so after graduation, he made his living private lessons. And his most important private lesson was the children of Rabbi Young. 2 years later, in 34, when Rabbi Young decided to open up a Talmud Torah, I was engaged as a teacher. And 1 year later, appointed principal. From 1934 to 1946, when I entered Torah Mesorah, I had the pleasure of regular communication with Rabbi Young. In those 12 years, he taught me much, giving me an appreciation for Torah Derech Eretz, and to use a modern expression, a touch of class. A touch of class. He was my first true mentor. And I modeled myself after him to a great extent. And he inspired me to make chinuch my career. And if you know Joe Kamenetsky, look at the picture. You'll see throughout the years, like a little Van Dyke, just like Rabbi Young. Rabbi Young's Van Dyke was a little longer, but you could see already the role model, Rabbi Young, Dr. Joe Kamenetsky, Rabbi, Dr. Very fascinating material. We'll describe their relationship. You're going to see something next week that, Charlie, you're going to only 36 dash to the IOU list. You'll have to pay it because it's on your roots, Yeki land. But leave it for next week. You'll have a good insight and a laugh.
What's the name of the two daughters? One was Rosalie.
Erna and Rosalie. Okay, so let me reiterate. What did we do today? All right, we touched upon Joe Kamenetsky, Yeshiva College, Rabbi Revel, and we've reached Rabbi Young and their relationship. And next week it'll all fall into place. Be'ezrat Hanatein Le'yav Koach. It's an exciting week next week, both the continuation of Moshe Sternbuch and the continuation of Rabbi Young. But I want to do something a little different now. And this is a very emotional time for any Jew living here. The Jews in Chutz Laretz, all of those living, listening, who are not part of the State of Israel, can't start to understand what life is like here. And this is an added bonus. Yom HaShoah, Yom HaZikaron, Hag Atzmaut. right now in the middle of a war, and it makes life as a Jew become very prominent in our existence. It's not just something secondary. The concept of Klal Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Adat Yisrael is with us. And over Pesach, in addition to all my regular learning, but since I try not to prepare to write, to prepare Shurim, but I don't have to, I do a lot of reading. So there's three books that I read over Pesach, and I want to talk about them. And these three books say it all. Years of Hara, Glimpse of Hope, The Diary of a Family in Hiding by Moshe Maltz. And Moshe Maltz happens to be Chaim Maltz, Herbie's father. How he wrote the book and kept such good notes. Where did he get the paper to keep the notes on her? Because it's so detailed.
Toilet paper.
Toilet, that's what you told me, toilet paper. I want to tell you, this book had such a profound impact on me. My wife said to me, you can't read it. It's too gruesome. I said, look, I know what went on. On that level, it's just frightening what the Hitler did to us, what the Germans did to us, what Europe did to us, what the world did to us. But there are two aspects that you see. One, the courage, the insight, Chaim's parents, the family, the decisions, the questions that came up, which I dealt with decades ago when I spent 5 years on the Holocaust. Were you here yet, Yitzchak? You were here, so you remember those lectures. No, a kid is crying. He'll give you away. Are you allowed to smother the kid? I just think of that question. That's halacha l'maisa. It's pikuach. There are 20 people hiding who will be killed if the Gestapo hears the kid crying. And it's not just the Gestapo. Neighbors who will squeal on this woman for hiding a Jewish family. And this comes up in the book. It came up, I spoke about a halacha l'maisa, b'gei haregah. I spoke about the Sefer Torah given in Haifa in the 70s, where everyone was crying. It was given in memory of a child that they killed to save their lives. No. Rodev. But there's another aspect to the book, and I wanna ask Chaim about it. That lady, here's a lady, what does she owe us? A Catholic lady, a Polish lady, her daughter. They would have been executed had they been discovered. And it's not just that she saved the lives of this entire family. It turns out at the end they learn another family was saved by her. Every day she brought them food. Every day she brought them food. How do you explain it? And it shows you that Rakefet is all wrong. How many times have I said I'd like to get on a plane and drop an atom bomb on Berlin? You can't do it. Because maybe you'll kill a million Nazis, but you'll also kill one person who risked his or her life to save Jews. Chaim, how long did it take? When did your father, when did the family apply to Yad Vashem to recognize her?
86.
And was she still alive in 86?
No.
No. So where was the ceremony?
At Yad Vashem.
And who did they bring in?
Grandchildren, her grandchildren.
And
my daughter.
And are you still in touch with the grandchildren today?
Yes.
Wow. And they're still in Poland?
No.
Where are they?
Connecticut.
Oh, that's right. How did they wind up in Connecticut? And did the Jews realize who these people are, who they descend from?
As a matter of fact, one of the children, one of his grandkids, married a Jewish girl.
Wow.
and gave the Israeli name to their offspring.
Wow, wow. I call a violent children should be chayes of a tshuva. They are Jewish. What a story! Now and then a movie was made.
My daughter produced it when she was a professor of journalism at Penn State with her husband, and with the video department and documentary department of Penn State, so they get the money. And they produce this film in 2009.
Wow.
10 years. And it's played all over the world.
And they went back to Poland. They were able to...
Not Poland, Ukraine.
Ukraine.
Now,
and the
at that point, that part of the world, countries switch.
Right. One second. And the barn is still there? The farm is still there?
Everything there like it was.
Like it was. Unbelievable. So... I need not tell you, you can, you look at the picture, you can see the resemblance between Herbie's father and Herbie, and I need not tell you, this is where we're coming from, and this is why we're here. And I often tell my grandchildren that my grandson did a movie, I have, you know, I have artists in my family, all types of geniuses in different fields.
But your wife is the best of them all.
No, my wife is no. The grandchildren are beyond my, are better, are more are professional.
I heard she was a pro.
No, my wife could have, yeah, say that. Had she had the right husband, I would have sat and learned and sent her to make a living. She was offered a lot of money for some of her work, but I told her, Baruch Hashem, we have food in our refrigerator. We don't sell. Let the grandchildren know who their grandparents were. So... You see why we're here. I often tell my grandson made a movie of the Holocaust, and my granddaughter just played it, made a reception with a Holocaust speaker in Piskatzev Mizrach. And they played the movie, and everyone's crying and says, and your grandfather, and you got to see the way my grandson portrayed me in the movie. I didn't know what he was doing. He just told me to wear a certain hat. Look at that. And they thought I'm a survivor. And my granddaughter said, no, my grandparents are third generation Americans. I said to my granddaughter, you're wrong. When I asked myself why we came in Aliyah, and you know, people mourned me and eulogized me, Rabbi, but what's the say? I don't want to talk about it now, it's not important. But no one could believe a Rosh Yeshiva and a rabbi and a kehillah growing, you're leaving. And the answer was very simple. Look what we've gone through, and that was Germany. And then just think for a minute, in the year 2019, the New York Times. Can you believe what you saw?
Yeah.
Just think for 1 minute.
Moshe Averick.
Yeah.
Is named after my father.
Moshe Averick is named after Moshe. Very nice. And look at the New York Times. And I said already to people, our greatest help in Aliyah is the New York Times.
What was the New York Times?
The cartoon, you don't know what we're talking about? I'll give it out shortly. If you don't know, Yitzchak, you're lacking knowledge. The world is shaking. And you don't know. Every newspaper here, every radio, every TV, New York Times, Jews, self-hating Jews.
They're Episcopalian now.
God have mercy. Say that. Anyway, this book speaks for itself, Yom HaShoah. But then let me go next. What was the high point of the year? Spent a year together. Many of you, my students, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, people listening, 40 years. What was the high point? You want to ask me the high point? When Malk and I brought those 13 ladies from the Ukraine. Here you have 13 girls, knew nothing about Yiddishkeit. Shvut Ami has classes in Odessa. Abriyot, the girls came. They were interviewed at the end of their stay here. You don't know how many already spoke about they only keep kosher. They're trying to keep Shabbat. They want to come back. They want to settle. One of the ladies who spoke here, and I got to tell Jack and Etta, you picked the wrong day not to be here. There's a time in life, it's like my graduation picture with Smicha, one of my best friends, the jerk, had a cold. He stayed home. All right? It's 60, 70 years later. You look at the picture, you're not there. All your children, grandchildren ask, how can it be? You got Smicha 61. Rakep had published the picture already twice in two different books. You're not there. So one of the ladies I brought out, and you have no idea how much Hashkacha Pratit there was Kira Sirota. Remember? So Kira, lo and behold, my student for so many years, listening, a sub-student, and she suddenly writes to me, well, I took a pitchfork out and I hooked her. I said, I'm bringing girls from Russia. You speak Russian. I need a translator. Remember, she spoke. It's not just that. Here. Sefer.
Haftorah.
Ask her. Could be her husband is. Haftorah unrolled. And she takes every Haftorah, retranslates it in a beautiful modern translation, and then explains to you the interconnection between the Haftorah and the Torah reading. And here, to Rav Rakefet, V'chol b'nayich limud yishon Rav Shalom b'nayich, from your sub-student who surfaced like a submarine, with blessings of health and strength for many, many years of teaching, Shir HaShirim, Mishlei and Kohelet, all at once, Kira Sirota. Now, who's this girl? Who's this lady? Born in Russia, doesn't know a thing, comes to Far Rockaway, early 90s. She tells us who played a big role in introducing them to Yiddishkeit. I almost fainted. Malka and I know that lady since the early 40s. Rebbetzin Steinhorn, Zichrona Livracha. Anyone who went to Salanta will remember Rabbi Steinhorn. This is his wife. She was widowed. She lived in Far Rockaway. She has a daughter living married to her from your community, Stone, Herman Stone. May name anything to you? His wife is a Steinhorn. It's her mother. And I remember the Stones telling me, I remember when we came back from Russia, when I was hunting for people to go to Russia, and she remember her telling me that there's a family from Russia. This is years later, in the 1990s, she's telling this to me, living in Far Rockaway, and her mother has been makar of them, and Kira and her sister became from, ultimately made the parents from. Kira's a PhD from Harvard, lives in Ranana 20 plus years. No, is this Yom Ha'atzmaut or isn't this Yom Ha'atzmaut? But then, unfortunately, before Yom Ha'atzmaut, there's Yom HaZikaron. Let us never forget the price we pay and just think that four more names were added to the list just yesterday. Here, I thank my dear Talmud, Rabbi Reuven Ziegler, who's I'm messing up names. One second. Rabbi Reuven Unger. Why did I say Reuven Ziegler? Because this morning I was talking with Sam about a Reuven Ziegler. Okay. Rabbi Reuven Unger of Shalavim lent me this book right before Pesach. I couldn't put it down. I xeroxed part of it. It'll figure God should enable me to give all the lectures I'm preparing on Torah in Lithuania. We're dealing in Novatic. But we lost Harab Eitan Shimon Henkin. Remember, he and his wife murdered by lowly Arab terrorists who should go to the New York Times and tell them their life story. Oh, God. And this they put together from Kitve Yad manuscripts. It is a fabulous volume. It is a perfect interaction of classic Talmud Torah and scholarly Mada HaYahadot. You should see the footnotes. And you cry when you think a kid 34 years of age murdered, and already they're able to put this together from his computer and his manuscripts and some articles he published, what he could have contributed. This is Hannah Henkin's son. It's Reb Yosef Eliyahu Henkin's great grandson and great granddaughter-in-law. What a magnificent volume! And the Aruch HaShulchan, very fascinating. The Aruch HaShulchan, the pittance of Lithuania, Klarkai, Psak, no Hasidus, nothing that's non-halachic. And in his community, he had the biggest Nevadic yeshiva with Rabbi Yisrael Horowitz living there, and the two of them interlocking many times, working hand in hand. And he describes that he's absolutely excellent. So these are three beautiful volumes that tell the story of our people. Now I have a lot to give out. First of all, I was furious with the New York Times like every other Jew, and I said it's no different than the Shtirma. And this cartoon from Yisrael Hayom says it all. I sent it on to America. Halavai, it should be publicized. If you wish, take a copy. This is the original New York Times cartoon. And here it says, the New York Shtirma. And Rebbeinu Shel Olam, it was never said better. This is for Yitz Rubin, Rabbi Hildesheimer's response to ultra-orthodoxy. One second. This is for Charlie, right where he grew up, literally around the corner, tremendous shootout in Washington Heights, policeman injured, the suspect killed. Did you know about this?
No.
Yeah, I think it's Cholamoid Pesach. Look at the picture, you recognize?
Yeah.
Yeah, there it is. I recognized it from when I was there.
My mother lives right there.
Oh my gosh. A moron is born every day. How morons survive and conquered the world is beyond my comprehension. This is the Jerusalem Post, which should be called the Palestinian Post again. They publish an article from the head rabbi at Temple Emmanuel, separating biblical mythology from biblical history. These are idiots. He's quoting Rabbi Wolpe, it's a Torah Misinai. His name is Joshua Davidson. And nothing, we never were in Egypt, we never left Egypt, we never received the Torah, it's all a lot of baloney. And he says here, it's very important to know this because then we could make peace with the Arabs. Why can't we make peace with the Arabs? Because we think God gave us this land. But if we get rid of this mythology, we can make peace.
And isn't that a group of Torah criticism at Eve University?
I can't, this is beyond anything I've ever seen. This is a beautiful article for Yitz, has earned it with his work for me in Russia. Beautiful article about the Russian immigration. And once again, Rakefet hit the nail on the head. I said there's never been a more successful immigration than the Russians. They own the country. Look at the politicians. Who's the head of the Knesset? No. Who are we talking about? No. Who's holding up the whole government? Avigdor Lieberman. It's beyond words. Julie Edelstein. The Palestinian Post. This is a beautiful article appeared in the Palestinian Post on Vic Geller, the Seder that Vic Geller held in 1945 as a chaplain's assistant, I think, but a fighting soldier with Patton's army occupied Germany. Very, very fascinating. Written by Vic Geller's son-in-law. Here's a whole collection of articles on the tragedy that we dedicated this year to yesterday about Rabbi Yisrael Goldstein and President Trump. Of course, all in memory of that poor lady who fell, killed because she went to say Yiska for her mother. Ah, it just breaks the heart. Lori Kay. Okay, so the whole group of articles. Shmuel B'Teyach received the Rakefet Award for the greatest defender of the Jewish people. His article against the New York Times is second to none. No holds barred, the old York Times. He begins by talking about York, England in the 12th century, where they're killing the Jews during the Crusades. What an article. Here's something for scientists. How do you fly a spaceship on Shabbat? With all the halakhic questions, and as I said to you, some of the prime members of the crew are not only Shomer Shabbos Jews, they're Hasidic Jews. Gay conversion therapy provider spoke at parent meeting at prominent Orthodox shul. That's Yeshiva University's high school for girls.
Sure.
Hosted a gay a conversion therapist who's fighting to be recognized, who's able to help people get to a more halachic lifestyle. In line with that article, Avram Moltik, Molak, or however you pronounce it, I'm an Orthodox rabbi who's going to start officiating LGBT, or whatever the heck that means, weddings. Here's why. Gotta rip kriya when you read this article. This is the opposite. At Yeshiva University, everyone got an email from Voloshin Yeshiva checking whether the teachers are saying things against halacha. This is in YU now, okay? So that's the opposite. Could you imagine? They call themselves Voloshin Yeshiva, and I understand why. They consider YU a direct continuation of Voloshin Yeshiva. This is from the New York Times about bat mitzvahs, what level of entertainment, what it's like with the girls, with their dresses, with Ribbono Shel Olam, what we have become. But all right, at least they're having bat mitzvahs and haven't forgotten totally that they're Jewish. New Jersey, where Lakewood Yeshiva exists, just enacted a law that you're allowed to take your own life if you're terminally ill. And Ribbono Shel Olam, how you can fit that together with halacha, I have no idea. Our dear friend, the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Yitzchak Lichtenstein, visits Los Angeles, and here it's with pictures, and all about his visit to Los Angeles. I'm happy and I'm sad at the same time. You can understand why. Yitzchak, we need you here. Beautiful article about Ben Hecht, what we spoke about in class, how he suffered and everyone disregarded him because he became a real Zionist. The Jewish treasures of Notre Dame, all about paintings in the cathedral that tell the story of the Jews in France that were destroyed. My memories of Harav Landau. We spoke about Rav Landau, Bnei Brak, his Hechsherim. He was a man who could not be bought. And now you have the, okay, so you want, you have the one, what do you call it, Mayan. You have Mayan, who took my, whoever wants it, so give it, whoever wants it. The latest issue of Mayan, as usual, very interesting. It follows the same concept of synthesizing classic learning with Madahayata. Anyone who has children, grandchildren, this was the last issue put out. It was edited. This is a student of mine from BMT who was here in the early 70s, if not 70, 71. His father was friendly with my cousin, with the Daniels, with the Kamenetskys, with the Chaim Zimmerman. And this kid, Aryeh, stayed on Aliyah. Perfect Hebrew, magic Hebrew, edited. This is for children, what you do for them for the Chag. He's now retiring, and in his honor, they put out a final issue, Midei Chodesh B'Chodesho, with all types of games and toys and concepts, how to entertain the children on Pesach, with concepts of Pesach. Latest issue of Jewish Action, I have to tell you, they really are on a level. And they're dealing here on how to succeed if you fail, problems, alcoholism, drugs, how to go further. Beautiful article of Benji Levine being interviewed about his grandfather. Terrific issues. This Yitzchak gave me, among others, Mishpacha, two recent issues. Mishpacha is Mishpacha. If they would publish pictures of women, I would subscribe to it. But as long as they don't publish pictures of women, I can't bring something to my house which goes against the very grain of Torah Hashem Tamima. The latest HaMizrahi with everything about sending people all over the world. This is why there's very little faculty here. They're all over the world speaking. And this is why in Beit Shemesh, one shul is shaking. They asked the Shaila yesterday, a lady supposed to speak there. Does she speak after the davening? How did they work it out? And I gave them the Raketet Psak that you make Kiddush. And then you reassemble those who want to come. But I can understand why so many Balabatim feel directly after you finish Aleinu, a lady gets up to speak in front of Darren Kodesh. I don't believe the Rav would be happy with that situation. Understatement. Here are two issues of this magazine which I never knew existed. Ezra magazine for the Anglo-Saxons, mainly for the Anglo-Saxons living in Herzliya, Ranana, that area. But very interesting, very high class, very fascinating, and very inspiring with a lot of nice material. So everyone is welcome. I want to thank you very much for your participation, and until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vitanya. Charlie, is Rabbi Bedmash here today?
No.
Okay.
He's giving a shir tomorrow. He moved the shir to tomorrow. Instead of a shir, he's coming back today.
Oh, he's coming.
So he moved the shir that's supposed to be Monday.
I see. He moved it to tomorrow, but he's coming back today.
Yeah, right.
Hey, Vanti. Okay, I feel better because I couldn't understand how he can jump to America, but he jumped for one day, basically.
Right.
One day.
Yeah.
I feel bad because I had to turn down the shoes.